This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Time to look into your lifetime income. Hello, everybody. I'm John Loeffler.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Now, this week, John and I are going to be talking about something that I think is pretty normal for most people to be thinking about this time of year. Maybe you haven't filed your taxes yet, and you still have time to make a last-minute contribution to an IRA or a Roth. You know, Jim and I often talk about different employer-sponsored retirement plans as ways to save for retirement, but today we're going to talk about a tax-deferred retirement savings vehicle that's available to everyone who has what's called employment compensation, the IRA, the Individual Retirement Arrangement. Now, Jim and I have talked about different employer-sponsored IRAs, the Simple IRA, the SEP IRA, and now the MIRA. But there are two types of IRAs I think almost everyone listening here is familiar with, the Roth and the traditional IRA. But I got to tell you, John, I always get asked questions, should I do a Roth contribution or a traditional IRA contribution? Which one is which? What are the benefits? What are the pros? What are the cons of each one? So we're going to cover that today.
Yeah, and on the employer side, there are also a number of non-IRA retirement plans you can offer your employees. There's 401k, defined benefit plans, profit-sharing plans, money purchase pension plans, cash balance plans, and you might guess the list goes on. Pam Means, president and consulting actuary of Means & Associates, a retirement plan design and consulting firm, is going to walk us through some examples of when certain types of plans and combinations of plans are appropriate later in the program.
So, John, why don't we start with some of the basic differences between Roth IRAs and traditional IRAs? For example, I think the most important difference people need to understand is when the government is going to take out the taxes from your contributions and distributions. It's the major differential between these two types of accounts. So, with Roth IRAs, the contributions are not tax deductible, which means that making contributions offers you absolutely no upfront tax benefits on your taxable income for the year. So you're basically putting money into your Roth IRA that you've already paid taxes on. So these contributions are considered 100% post-tax contributions. Now, with traditional IRAs, contributions may or may not be tax deductible, which means there may or may not be an upfront tax benefit.
Okay, why do you say they may be tax deductible? I mean, the thinking was that traditional IRA contributions were always tax deductible.
Well, I think this is an important thing for people to understand, John, because traditional IRA contributions are only maybe tax deductible because the amount of your contribution may or may not be fully deductible depending on two things. Number one, your income level, and number two, whether or not you or your spouse are covered by a retirement plan at work. I think this is an important thing for people to think about, because if you're trying to make an IRA contribution to reduce your taxable income, if it's not going to make a difference to your taxable income, you might want to think about doing other things with that money. So let's just start with an example. So for single people like me, if we're covered by a retirement plan at work, and we have a modified adjusted gross income of $69,000 or more, our traditional IRA contributions are not tax deductible at all. So if I'm making more than $69,000 a year, I don't get any tax benefit at all from making a contribution to an IRA. And if my income is between $59,000 and $69,000, I only get a partially deductible contribution. So for couples, the modified AGI limits are a little bit higher, partial deductibility between $95,000 and $115,000, and not deductible at all after $115,000. Now, these are 2013 numbers. The 2014 numbers are a little bit higher. And that's if you're covered by a retirement plan at work. Now, if you and your spouse are not covered by a retirement plan at work, there's no income limit at all for taking a deduction for your IRA contribution. So if you're making $200,000 a year or $400,000 a year, government doesn't care. You can still make an IRA contribution. And because you're not covered by a retirement plan at work, your IRA contribution is fully tax deductible. And if you're married and one of you is covered by a retirement plan, same differential as being a single and covered by a retirement plan at work, If you're married and one of you is covered by a retirement plan at work, there are income limits after which your IRA contribution is only partially deductible. So again, if you've got a retirement plan going on, there's some income requirements in terms of deductibility of your IRA contributions, but you can still make those IRA contributions.
Let me see if I understand this. So if Carol and I made more than, we'll use last year's amounts, $115,000 combined, and we have a retirement plan, if we add money to a traditional IRA, that doesn't reduce our taxable income at all. So I guess the real logical question would be, why do we do a traditional IRA contribution anyway?
Well, if say you and Carol are in that situation where you made more than $115,000 last year, so your IRA contributions aren't tax deductible at all, you know, if you're interested in an upfront tax benefit, then obviously making a contribution to your IRA is not really the best way to make use of that money because it's not going to make any difference to your taxable income. But you may want to think about doing a Roth contribution instead. So there may be a reason to do a Roth contribution. You can still do a traditional IRA contribution if you're able to do it. But in terms of doing that when you're not getting an upfront tax benefit, you're basically looking at that contribution as a way to maximize tax-deferred growth on your savings. So no upfront tax benefit, but you're looking at maximizing tax-deferred growth of your savings. Now, the alternative is if your income level allows it to do the Roth contribution, because if you're not going to get an upfront tax benefit anyway, maybe you should just put the money into a Roth IRA. So you can always make an IRA contribution regardless of your income level. It just may or may not be fully or partially tax deductible, but there are income limits to making a Roth contribution. So if you're single, you can do a full contribution if your income's up to $112,000, and a partial contribution if your income is between $112,000 and $127,000, but we're not eligible at all to make contributions if our income's over $127,000. And again, for joint filers, same deal. You can make full contributions to your Roth up to $178,000 of your income as joint filers, and partial contributions up to $188,000. Again, these are 2013 numbers. 2014 numbers are a little bit higher. So if you're in a situation where you're over the limit to get a tax deduction on your traditional IRA contribution, but you're under the limit over which you can't make a Roth contribution, you're kind of in a little sweet spot there, you can make a Roth contribution that year and get the benefits of tax-deferred growth and some of the benefits of putting money in a Roth contribution in terms of the taxation on the outgoing side.
You realize you're making my head spin here, don't you?
You sort of get yourself in a situation where, you know, is it or isn't it tax deductible? And the IRS website has a really great little chart that shows you exactly what's going on. So, you know, go to the IRS.gov website and type in contribution limits on their little search bar, and lots of different resources pop up with some little charts that kind of outline all this stuff for you.
Sometimes a chart does much more than a lot of verbiage to tell you what you should be doing. But let's say that Carol and I make enough that we don't get any upfront tax benefit from doing a traditional IRA contribution, but our income level still qualifies us for a full Roth contribution. Why would we do a Roth IRA contribution in this scenario?
Well, we're talking about the major difference between the Roth and traditional IRAs, which is, when does the government take the taxes? When do they get their piece of the pie? So with Roth IRAs, you pay the taxes on the front end before you make the contribution. But in most cases, you aren't charged taxes on the back end or when you take money out of the Roth IRA. So contributing to a Roth IRA can mean tax-free distributions down the road, even though there's no upfront tax benefit now. Now, I have to point out an important point, which is that Roth IRAs have a 5-year aging requirement. So contributions withdrawn before 5 years after the first contribution are subject to penalties, although there are some exceptions. That's kind of the one thing to think about when you're doing a Roth contribution.
Okay.
So in the case of the traditional IRA, depending on whether or not your contributions were fully or only partially tax deductible, or as the government likes to call it, pre-tax versus post-tax contributions, your distributions may also be either fully or partially taxable. So the tax you pay on distributions from a traditional IRA is proportionate to the amount of pre-tax versus post-tax money in your IRA. And I should also remind our listeners, in most circumstances, although there are some exceptions for buying a home or financial hardship, there's a 10% early withdrawal penalty if funds are pulled out of either a Roth or a traditional IRA before the owner of the account reaches the age of 59 and a half.
Okay, so that answers the upfront versus the back-end tax benefit or taxability between the two types of IRAs. Now, isn't there also a big difference in how you're supposed to take what are called mandatory distributions from your Roth IRAs or versus your traditional IRAs?
Actually, a big difference, John. You know, right now, the IRS expects you to start taking money out of your IRAs at age 70 and a half. They don't want the money to stay tax deferred forever, right? They want their piece of that tax pie. So mandatory distributions from your IRA start at age 70 and a half. And any amount you're supposed to distribute but don't gets charged a 50% tax penalty.
That sounds like you take it or we're going to take it.
Exactly. So I think the big difference people need to be aware of between traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs when it comes to these mandatory distributions is that Roth IRAs are not, let me say that again, are not subject to the mandatory distribution requirement. So for folks who either want to leave a bigger tax-free nest egg for their heirs or people who anticipate having a high income level in retirement, maybe you're someone who has a big deferred compensation package coming to you, or because you had a huge 401k, your IRA withdrawal amount's going to be pretty massive, contributions to a Roth IRA might be an option to discuss with your tax advisor. And here's the big kicker. You can only contribute to a traditional IRA until you're 70 and a half, but you can contribute to a Roth IRA until you die, as long as you have employment compensation.
Well, I guess that would seem to make sense. I mean, it wouldn't be logical to keep putting money into the traditional IRA after age 70 and a half if you're only having to keep withdrawing chunks of it as part of your mandatory distribution.
Yeah, not super logical to be doing that. Take it in, put it out. Put it in, take it out. Yep.
Okay, so I know the contribution limits keep changing every year. What are the limits right now? I know we're looking at the years 2013, 2014.
Right. So for 2013 and 2014, the contribution limit for both Roths and traditional IRAs combined, you can only contribute this amount between those two types of IRAs combined, is $5,500 or $6,500 if you're 50 or older. So for folks under 50, $5,500. For folks over 50, $6,500 or 100% of employment compensation, whichever is less.
All right. So there's a little benefit to having gray hair. Of course, I never had to worry about that. I don't have any. It's all right. So, so I can contribute more to my IRAs now, right?
That's right. One of those secret benefits of aging, John, is that you get certain little cushy things from the government this way. So you can also contribute more to your 401ks when you're over 50, for example. But anyway, before we close, I just want to clarify the difference between two very similar types of IRAs, the rollover IRA and their traditional IRA.
Now, I thought rollover IRAs were where you put your 401k or 403b or 457 money when you retire.
Yep, that's right. But you could also just move your 401k type assets into a traditional IRA rather than a rollover IRA.
Yeah, but why would I move the 401k into a rollover IRA, say, versus a traditional IRA or vice versa?
Well, you know what, John? Structurally, there's really no difference between those two types of IRAs. It's really just a semantic, in other words, just a naming difference. But in terms of their structure and how they're handled, they're exactly the same. But the reason to keep funds from a rollover IRA and traditional IRA separate are really more of a matter of the ease of record keeping more than anything else. So here's what I mean by that. When you take a withdrawal from a traditional IRA or a rollover IRA, or even do a Roth conversion out of either of those two types of IRAs, the tax you pay on the distribution is proportionate to the amount of pre-tax versus post-tax money in all of your rollover IRA and traditional IRA accounts combined. So again, it's proportional taxation of pre-tax, post-tax contributions. Now you can imagine, John, after many years of contributing to IRAs and 401ks, that trying to figure out the proportion of pre-tax versus post-tax money could just be a record-keeping nightmare as far as digging back to see how much you contributed in, I don't know, 1985, and was it pre-tax or post-tax or partially pre-tax and partially post-tax. You can see, you get a little bit, your eyes would start to sort of glaze over trying to figure this out.
I can see them swimming.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But here's the good news about keeping your what they call contributory monies, like your contributory IRA money that you're putting into a traditional IRA, you're contributing your $5,500 every year. separate from your former employer-sponsored money, is that if you're really clean about how you handle what goes into your accounts that are titled rollover IRAs, and make sure all the money in those accounts are all untaxed contribution money, like old 401k money, you can see how it'd make it a lot easier to figure out pre versus post tax amounts when you go to the time of your life when you start to make withdrawals from those monies. It's just really, honestly, John, it's sort of like you just name the rollover IRA the rollover because it reminds you, hey, everything in here is all pre-tax money. It's going to be 100% taxable when it's taken out. So it's just a little, I don't know, kind of like a memory reminder or a little bit of a way of labeling things so it's easier to remember, you know, what was all pre-tax versus post-tax. So it's just more a matter of ease of record keeping more than anything else.
All right, Catherine, before we close the program today, let's make sure and remind our listeners here that they still have until April 15th of this year, 2014, to make a Roth contribution or an IRA contribution for tax year 2013.
And I also want to remind our listeners to consult with their own personal tax professional when deciding if an IRA contribution or a Roth contribution or any contribution at all makes sense for your family. And coming up next, I and Pam Means, the president and consulting actuary of Means & Associates, a retirement plan design and consulting firm here in San Diego, are going to give our business owner listeners some ideas about how to structure their retirement plans to best benefit their employees and their businesses. Now, we've been having a lot of crazy weather across the country recently, so until next week, everybody, stay safe, stay warm, and stay dry. If you're one of our listeners and you happen to be a small business owner, or maybe you're not the business owner yourself, but you have a friend or a child or a parent who's a small business owner, and you've realized that they aren't saving for retirement for themselves, they haven't set up a retirement plan yet for their business, I think you're going to want to encourage them to listen to this next interview. I'll be talking with Pam Means. She is the president and consulting actuary of Means & Associates here in San Diego. And her firm specializes in matching businesses with retirement plans that not only maximize their ability to put money away tax deferred, but also helps maximize their tax benefit for doing so. And also matches plans with not only the present state of the business, but its future state as well. So again, if you're someone who owns a small business, maybe know someone who does, really want to pay attention to this next segment with Pam Means of Means & Associates. I got to thinking after we talked about some ideas for the program today that we really should probably start off with a really basic question, which is, what is a retirement plan actuary and why does an employer need one?
Well, retirement plan actuary is a person who, number one, is an expert in lots of the laws and regulations, et cetera, that have to do with retirement plans, but in particular is also federally licensed to practice in that area and tends to be an individual that knows what I always like to call the third subparagraph rule of the Internal Revenue Code. So really dives deep and knows how things work, what needs to be done, how to calculate plan benefits, look at plan design for employers, et cetera.
Well, I was really hoping to talk to you about this whole idea of plan design for employers today, just because I know you and I had worked on a case together where we had someone who was trying to decide what type of retirement plan to set up for his business and really kept being drawn to the SEP IRA because of the presumed simplicity of that program. But after we talked to you for a while, we realized that for his income level and for the situation he was in, he really needed a blended 401k profit sharing plan. So I was wondering if you could walk us through a couple of examples of how you, as a plan actuary, come to the determination of what type of plan suits what type of employer or employment situation.
Yes, actually, that's a great question because there isn't one size that fits all. There isn't one plan that satisfies everyone's needs for all time and forever. And so plan design is important to say, where are we now and what do we want to do? How much do we want to spend as a deductible amount contributing to ourselves, for example, as plan sponsors and also to participants? And then where do we go from there? What happens with the business? How does it grow? So plan design takes into account where the client is currently and where they're expecting to go over time. And a good plan design has the ability for the plan to grow with the needs of the plan sponsor and the demographics, very importantly, of the employees, but also has a good plan design, sets up a plan that allows for example, transitions into another kind of plan that is expansive as the business grows, as the needs increase, and certainly as the plan sponsor employer gets closer to retirement and wants to be sure that retirement benefits are there for him or herself.
Well, I know that a lot of our listeners are people who run their own businesses. A lot of them tend to be, you know, engineers who work as consultants for firms that they've actually retired from, for example. And we also have a lot of medical professionals that we work with. And I know that sometimes it's very easy for these people to move to, say, a SEP IRA or a simple IRA plan, but that may not really necessarily, like you were saying, it may not always meet that need for growth or for even increases in income. It may not meet the need for a higher level of deductible contributions.
Yes, the SEP does have a use, and everyone needs to find what that is. But the SEP has up to a three-year eligibility, but it's not three full years. It's any employee that worked at least one day in each of 3 years. That's not really what normally one thinks of three-year eligibility. Vesting is 100%. What does that mean? Whatever money is put in, the moment that it's put in for an employee, that person is entitled to all of it. There's no requirement to stay around for a while to earn rights to that money. And then thirdly, in general, in a SEP, if one person is going to get, the principal wants to get a contribution of, say, 15% of pay, then everyone's getting a contribution of 15% of pay. So it can limit you, if you want to take a large deduction, it can limit you in what you can do. If you want to, for example, benefit longer-term employees more than the shorter-term. You want the shorter-term folks to stay longer so they can see that they're starting to increase the kind of benefits they're getting. You want the principals to be able to leverage and tax advantage the contributions that go into the plan. And you want all of those contributions to be safe from creditors. You want all those contributions to be sort of locked away. And certainly you want all those contributions and all those assets not to be ever considered part of your assets. So you need to be careful about what plan you set up and then also how the plan operates. So you get all the great tax advantages of a well-run plan. And then you have the ability, as time goes on, as I mentioned, to add another plan on. Internal Revenue Code is really wonderful, I have to tell you, in one respect, and that is that putting in combinations of plans for the individuals that you mentioned, engineers, medical professionals, etc., there are some great opportunities for some great tax savings and tax deferral in combinations of plans that a lot of times people say to me they're surprised that that's in the Internal Revenue Code, but it is with the plan that retirement plans are supposed to be long-term benefits for individuals.
Sometimes I think it's helpful for our listeners to kind of have a more tangible example of certain different types of plans that you might set up for someone under certain conditions. I know we've talked before about really high wage earners. Would you mind walking us through an example of a plan scenario for someone who's a fairly significant wage earner of their own business?
Yes, I certainly will. We actually had an example recently. We had a medical professional who has no employees, had put in a SEP, and in order to get the maximum deduction for the SEP, the individual needed to take a large enough salary so that the percentage of pay could hit the max limit, which is now $52,000. What we did was we stepped in and took a look at that and said that person actually could drop taxable income sizably by making it be a 401k profit-sharing combination. And as a result, we could have $70,000 less in taxable pay for the individual and still have the same tax advantage contribution going in because it was a combination of 401k deferrals, not taxable, and employer money, not taxable, to add up to the same $52,000. That was an example. That same individual is looking for the future after his practice is developing even more into being able to add on to that. I won't say simply straightforward because we did some very interesting design work in there, but that 401k profit sharing plan to be able to add on a cash balance plan in the future. And a cash balance plan is a type of defined benefit plan that works very, very well with minimum and maximum numbers and deductions and things like that, when that individual starts to take in some other business partners. where we can have differentiated dollar amounts going in and contributing for individuals as well as employees, and being able to really manage the cash flow of the business as this professional business increases. So he sees that as the next steps in about 4 or 5 years.
So what it sounds like happened was, by transitioning this professional from his SEP IRA structure, you were able to basically assist with his level of tax deduction, keep his level of contribution high, but it also sounds like he ended up with a plan that was a lot more flexible in terms of what could or should or has to be contributed by the employer and employee, and also scalability, which is how easy it is to add more people onto the program.
Absolutely. We actually designed the plan as though he had employees, and one wants to do that. You want to have a plan that has provisions for the future hiring of employees. And so we put provisions in to talk about when future employees would become eligible and when his funding for them would start and how they would earn rights to his funding, called vesting, over a period of time, and what other types of provisions we have for them. We're not using them right now. Didn't cost more to put them in, but now he's ready. He doesn't have a plan that says the moment you're hired, you're in the plan, because he wants to be able to have a plan that he looks at some eligibility time for new employees, and he wants to have a plan that encourages his employees to stay with his firm and help contribute to the success of the firm.
What I think is actually something that a lot of times, especially smaller employers, get so focused on the tax deduction side of it, they forget that if their business does grow, they want a plan that's flexible enough to grow, but also flexible enough so that they don't end up, like you were mentioning, making mandatory contributions for employees who may or may not have a sense of loyalty or prove their loyalty to his company.
And also looking at what the cost is. And so we like to have some eligibility periods so we can tell the employer, here is the cost of having the plan. And so this is part of what you need to start considering as the entire, I'll put in quotes, compensation package, especially as you're hiring in professionals and assistants. This is the compensation package that you are offering. And it's a wonderful concept to start thinking of everything. It's not just the pay, it's the entire package that someone's coming in for, and being able to plan that for that and be able to manage that and also be able to express that potentially when you're making an offer to a new employee.
You mentioned something when you were talking about the structure of this particular plan for this individual about the potential for a future cash balance plan. I'm wondering if you have an example for us in terms of a type of plan that would work well, or a situation that would work well for a cash balance plan.
I certainly do, and we see these a lot. For example, in medical practice, with a number of physicians who are partners, and then potentially even some physicians who are, if you will, associates, not yet partners. And so we have in the past set up plans where perhaps one of the partners who is past having to pay off school loans, or has their children have already been established and gone through college, those partners are putting in contributions into the cash balance plan, which is once again a type of defined benefit plan that's looking like a pretty high percentage of pay. And some of the newer partners coming in that have some of those liabilities and they're not ready to take on full bore the plan could have a smaller number going into the plan. So we've designed quite a few where one of the partners is putting twice the amount in that the other partner is, and then we look at the employees, the rank and file, the associates, the upcoming physicians, and put scaled bouts of funds that are going in for them over time as they age or change their responsibility. It is called tiering in a plan, and it is quite common in most retirement plans. Not everyone, not the newest employee in versus the person who's been there 20 years, they all don't get the same benefit. You work through to earn the rights to the higher benefit over time.
I was wondering if you would mind, just for the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with all of these different plans, would you mind going over just really quickly a defined benefit plan versus a 401k, what the difference is between those two plans?
Certainly. A 401k plan is a type of profit-sharing plan. Profit-sharing plans mean contributions are discretionary. They're not fixed. So a 401k plan has the ability to have multiple types of discretionary contributions. The first one is the 401k salary deferrals. Each participant can choose, do I want to take money out of my paycheck or not? And if I do, here's the percentage I want every pay period. If I don't, right now I won't, perhaps later on I will. That's the first discretionary level. The second discretionary level might be an employer match. If you put money into the plan employee, I'm going to give you 50 cents on the dollar on that. So that's discretionary match. It might be 50 cents on the dollar, or it might be dollar for dollar match. It might be 10 cents on the dollar, and the employer has the discretion about setting that up. The third kind of discretionary part to a profit-sharing 401k plan is just across-the-board contributions for everyone. You employee put some money in, I'll give you some money also through the plan, I'll contribute it to your account. You found that you couldn't afford to put money in, you're still going to have some money going in, and that's a discretionary issue for the employer, choosing the dollar amounts, the levels, the limits, and if you have what I would say that's a nicely designed plan, also the differentiating percentages by person every year. So that's all very discretionary. You turn it off and on every year. A defined benefit plan is, by definition, a kind of plan that defines the amount of money that's going to come out to people as a stream of payment once they hit retirement age, or perhaps even if once they terminate or become disabled or hit early retirement. And so a defined benefit sets that stream of payments based on a formula. And then how much you fund depends on how far you are from the time where the person needs to get that money. Somebody who has 45 years until they're going to need the money has usually a lower amount going in for them because it's got a lot of years to have investment earnings on it. Somebody who is closer to retirement is going to have more money generally going in because there isn't a lot of time to catch up by the time they hit retirement age. But it is a formula. So a formula for retirement for defined benefit might be when you retire, we'll take your three highest years salary, three consecutive, take the average of those, and we'll pay you a benefit of 25% of that pay for the rest of your life. Or we'll say, take your three highest years of salary and we'll give you a benefit that is both based on that pay and also how long you work. So somebody who worked longer might get 35%. Somebody who worked a shorter period of time by the time they retire might get 20% of pay. So the plan is reserving, is a good actuarial word, for a future contingent event, and that is that the person retires and has funds. Now, in a closely held business and in smaller plans, there usually aren't annuity payments. You certainly can go out to an insurance company and buy one, but generally in smaller plans, the disbursement of benefits are normally a lump sum. You pay the person the amount of money they need. They take it, roll it to an IRA, and then go on. So that's a defined benefit. You define how much is coming out, and then you figure out how to put the money in. The law allows you minimum numbers and maximum numbers to put in, depending on, in part, the ability of the employer to pay each year.
So essentially, one of the major differences between the 401k profit sharing and the defined benefit plan is not only sort of how they're structured in terms of who's contributing, in the case of the 401k, the employer and the employee can contribute. Defined benefit plan, it sounds like it's all employer money. And it sounds like for the defined benefit plan, it's not really a discretionary plan. The employer has a certain benefit level that they're trying to reach per the terms of the plan, and then there are sort of mandatory contributions every year to try to meet that eventual payout rate.
It is true. I want to tell you, there are kinds of defined benefit plans. You see them more in back east in manufacturing companies where they do have mandatory contributions by employees, by the way, to contribute, but we don't see them as much in the West Coast. But you're right, there are mandatory employer contributions, and then the investment earnings on the plan make up some. But a good actuary is watching to say, here's the maximum, and you've got the available cash this year. Put the maximum in so you can sort of put a little bit more in now to save up for yourself for tough years in the future where you can't come up with something. Because the more you pay in advance within the deductible limits, then that minimum number starts dropping because you've already been paying in advance. And so really good planning is watching out about the minimum and the maximum and giving good advice to the client about what the effect is of consistently putting the minimum number in is, what you can do with putting a higher amount in, and really a lot of very hands-on, if you will, consulting directly with the client. This isn't, you know, the mysterious curtain where data goes in and then a hand comes out with a letter on it that says, here's your contribution number. There's got to be a lot of communication and sharing on a confidential basis what's happening with the business so that we can be most helpful.
Because it sounds like what you're basically talking about in good years is essentially pre-funding, in a way,
yes,
pre-funding future years' contributions so that, again, setting aside some of that contribution money now, pre-funding, so that in lean years, you've got a little bit more cushion in terms of the minimum you have to contribute.
Yeah, and that makes a good design to find out what are those minimum and maximums, and not designing so that every time you have to put the max in, nor designing that the minimum is impossible even to meet on a regular basis. So that lends itself to good plan design to find a good road through and find out also what are the client's expectations. Is it a steady growth industry? Is it fairly static? Or are there a lot of ups and downs? Now, we can't always take a look at the economy and know exactly what's going to happen, but there are some industries that have different growth patterns, and we talk about that.
Well, it also sounds like a lot of what you do is similar to what we do in terms of counseling with the client as far as what's going on with their overall planning. You know, we're thinking more from the retirement income end of things, and you're thinking about refunding that number essentially on your end, but also looking at the health of the business and how to create a retirement plan that not only benefits the employer and the employee, but also keeps in mind the health of the business as well. You mentioned a few times about consulting together with the client to come up with numbers that make sense. And you also mentioned something earlier, too, about making sure that your plan meets certain requirements. And I'm wondering if you could talk just briefly about some of the services that actuaries perform in terms of plan testing for discrimination, for example, and making sure that the employer is meeting their contribution requirements for their plan so they don't get in trouble with ERISA or the IRS.
Certainly, both actuaries and other third-party administrative firms who work in the retirement industry know a long list of different types of tests that you have to meet so that it's not discriminatory, you're covering the right individuals. And so those are done every year. We collect data, we find out information about ownership of the business, officers, et cetera. And then we go through a series of tests, and then the tests and all that consulting are really the body of plan administration and actuarial work. The outcome that people always think of as the one and only thing is actually an annual report that goes into the Internal Revenue Service. It's not a tax return. It's an annual report that goes into the IRS and Department of Labor that says some basic things. It doesn't identify individuals. It identifies the business and how much money went in and how many people were covered and questions answered. And that's the end result of this due diligence that you go through. If the plan is not passing some tests there, depending on the test, there are a number of remedies. Some of them may require more employer contributions, but normally we're watching out for that as a plan is heading into that area, so we don't know what's going to happen and are we ready for that. And some require taking money back away in a 401k plan, taking deferrals back out of the plan and refunding them to the individuals. Some of them may require an amendment to the plan. And that's part of the whole process is periodically the IRS tells us when plans need to be restated. We're going into a big restatement time now for certain standardized plans and volume submitter plans. Starts May 1st of this year and will end April 30th, 2 years from now. We're waiting to hear the final word on that from the IRS, but laws change, and so the tests change, the rules change, the wording in the plan document, and we just have to stay on top of it, be proactive, and tell our clients ahead of time, I don't like surprises.
Well, it sounds like you're performing a lot of functions for people I think that a lot of employers, especially small business employers, may not be aware of, which is the discrimination testing, the fact that you consult with your clients about the level of contributions they should be making each year. So it's a very interactive experience in terms of how much you contribute each year. You help them stay on top of amendments to the plan as required by changes in ERISA regulation and law. And also I was thinking, too, something a lot of people don't think about is what about when it comes time to wind down the plan? You know, that's a whole different level of things. I was wondering if you talked also about some things to think about when winding down a plan.
Certainly. we help with that type of thing, plan termination. You don't just stop a plan. You have to make sure that all the amendments are updated that the plan had. You have to send notices out to participants, need to have some clearly defined consent action, board resolution, some sort of legal piece from the plan for its files to say at this date we stopped. Some clients choose, in fact, to go through the full IRS submission to have the IRS bless it and say, I see everything that happened in the past with the plan. It's fine. You're all updated with your plan documents. You're handling all the participants properly. You're paying everybody out the right amount. We're going to tell you, go ahead and give you a letter to say you're okay. Some choose not to, and the IRS then has the discretion to come and audit the plan or not at their choice. But it is a process. I hear a lot of people say, I terminated the plan, and I go, great, where's the resolution? We didn't do that. Did you pay people out? No, we haven't yet, and that type of thing. So there's just a routine. Is it difficult? It can be. Is it manageable? Absolutely.
Kind of sounds like you have to have someone sort of guiding you through it, though.
Yes, you do. I just met yesterday with someone who has a number of clients and said, we need some help on some things like this. And so we're actually going to be retained for a number of clients of this individual just to make sure everything's running properly, do the annual types of work, do the intermediary all during the year, contact times, updates, answering questions, helping out with paying out former employees, all that type of thing. And in some clients, the event of actually moving into terminating the plan. So it's an ongoing relationship. It is not a once-a-year relationship, and we value that relationship with all of our clients. And we really, really enjoy working with them.
I was going to ask you as well, you know, I have a lot of people ask me, what level of income should I be making before I start exploring these different retirement plan options? I know that everybody's situation is a little different. Do you have sort of a broad rule of thumb as far as if you're making between this amount and this amount, you might want to consider talking to someone like an actuarial firm about possible different retirement plan structures?
I think it has to do with your taxation. I'll go from the other side. When you're getting to the point where you're paying a lot in taxes and you're realizing that a lot of your net worth is in your business and there's nobody who's saving for you for retirement, that's the time. We've had people come and talk to us who are making $40,000, $60,000, $80,000. We've had people come talk to us who are making well into six figures, into seven figures. But I always think of it, the sort of bell rang someplace. Might be someone like you, Kaplan, who said you need to go see someone like this, maybe the accountant, maybe the attorney for this individual or for that business, to say it's time to start thinking about saving for retirement and doing it in a tax-advantaged way.
I really want to thank you for all of the input you provided on different types of plans today, Pam. And I think I really like this last bit that you said, where it's not so much about the income level, but about who's saving for retirement for you. And if you're the business owner and you're realizing that you're the only one saving for retirement for yourself, you know, maybe it's time that you start taking advantage of all of these different tax structures that are out there for you to really move forward with a retirement plan that helps you put money away from retirement in the way that makes the best sense for you and your business.
Absolutely. It's a really valuable tool that I think gives business sponsors more options when it is time to shut down the business or sell the business. They've got a lot of options because this isn't the one and only thing that's coming in for retirement. They have the security of retirement income. Now they can do whatever they need to negotiate their time, their price, whatever they need to do to remove themselves from the business. And if they've got family members in there, not burden the family members with trying to pay them an annuity out of the business.
That's another really great point, too, is I think this goes back to the overall flexibility of a retirement plan, too. And I like that it's not just about the flexibility of the plan itself. It's about the plan giving you as the employer more flexibility in how you not only run the business when you're actively involved, but also stepping out of the business as well. And that's something, frankly, hadn't occurred to me until you just said it, that having those funds for retirement set aside in certain ways means that it's easier to exit the business without putting a burden on the business itself or putting all of your eggs in one basket with the business in terms of your retirement.
Yeah.
Well, Pam, once again, I really appreciate you agreeing to come on the Financial Sense NewsHour's Lifetime Income Program. As always, I learn something new whenever I talk to you. So thanks again for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and I really appreciate the invitation, Kathleen.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking again soon, Pam. Thanks so much for coming on. Well, that concludes this segment of our program, and we really appreciate you joining us. Until next week, Jim and I hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.